Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoors, the official podcast of Living the Dream Outdoor Properties. We live by the motto, it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. And we live the outdoor lifestyle every day. Whether you're a landowner or dreaming of joining the ranks of those closest to the earth, we're your brothers and sisters of the outdoors. We hunt, we fish, we're stewards of the land. And our Living the Dream team will show you the way to enjoying the land and all the outdoor pursuits it has to offer. Here's your host, Bill Cooper.
Welcome to Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. I'm Bill Cooper, and I'm at the Missouri Outdoor Communicators Convention in Cape Girardeau, Missouri this weekend. And I've met up with a lot of old friends that I've known for decades. And I have with me now Eugene Vail and Joe. They're longtime friends, known them for decades, and they're a pretty interesting couple. Joe's actually a trained geologist, correct, Joe?
Geologist and degrees in geology and in writing. So basically, it's rocks and, rocks and writing.
You betcha. And Jean's a biology type, so you guys, I think, have a lot to talk about.
She says together we make a planet.
That's absolutely true. But you guys have had an interesting career over the last few decades, and we've known each other through the Missouri Outdoor Communicators. And Joe, how did you get in the outdoor communications business? What brought you to it?
The person that worked for the Labor Tribune also worked for Bobby Whitehead. Bobby Whitehead worked for Ed Finkelstein. And a friend of mine is Ed Finkelstein's brother-in-law. And at some point, Bobby said something about, I'd really like somebody to write a column for the outdoor guy that isn't just hunting and fishing.
Well, you filled the bill. For sure. But, gosh, you wrote for Bobby then for what? How many decades?
I wrote for him from 1998 until 2007. And that's when I was hired by Emery Styron to work for the River Hills Traveler. And I wrote for Emery for until 2014 when he sold the paper to another person.
Yeah, so that's a pretty lengthy writing career. Are you still doing some writing today?
I'm doing some writing. What I'm doing at this point in my life is I'm running a little business called Pawpaw Poets Publishing.
Yes.
And I am doing poetry and outdoor essays, interesting stories, for example, what it's like to go gigging in December when it's 20 degrees. And basically have published a number of small books. The one I'm working on right now is on the Jack's Fork. I have a book that is on the Current River, one on Alley Spring. I'm working on the Jack's Fork. When I get the three of these little ones put together, we're going to put it into a bigger book. And it's
awesome.
Basically going to be, it's more my thoughts on the outdoors because I have spent, I started writing cave-related stuff in 1986. So what is that? 86. That's almost 40 years.
Almost 40 years.
Of writing about rocks and various outdoor topics.
Absolutely. And I've enjoyed the books that you have produced. I met you down on Current River a year or so ago in an event, I think at Big Rock Candy Mountain, if
yes.
I remember right, and picked up your books. And they sit right on the table next to my recliner that I spend a lot of time in. So I've read those books and keep going back to them and referring to them and looking through them. And good piece of work, I got to say. Well, Joe, I don't want to give you the whole show, so let's jump over to Gene. Gene, how did you get involved in the outdoor communications world?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I was a killer pre-med undergrad. A killer pre-med is someone who would kill to get into medical school, but I still didn't get in.
Yeah.
But I'd become interested in the environment as from in high school and on through. And so I got a master's degree in biology, but concentrating basically on ecology. And I was going caving with the caving group, which was the most environmental group on campus, because I was at St. Louis U and they disbanded the Institute for Environmental Studies. I think I was the last person to get a certificate in environmental studies from them. But at any rate, people would ask me what stuff was, and I would point it out and tell them what it was and so forth. And I said, thought to myself, gosh, gee, wouldn't this be neat to be paid to do this? And I was working in an optical electronics factory at the time, but I did manage to get started as a seasonal interpreter in Merrimack and Babbler. And then Onondaga Cave moved into the system with the death of Lester Dill. And, you know, it was like, oh, my, this couldn't be, have been created better for me. So and I was there for 17 years, and then I was moved up into the central office in Jefferson City and seemed to have avoided the brain damage that affects anybody who winds up in Jefferson City.
I know I avoided that too. Joe and I were talking just before you walked into the room, and I discovered that I was in the state park system the same time you were at Onondaga. I was the naturalist over at Bennett Springs and supervised the naturalist Montauk, but I was there for a very short period of time. Wow. You remember how we all almost starved to death. That was before state parks had their tax money. Mm-hmm. And when I got my first paycheck, it was about 30% short. And I had two children at the time and another one on the way. And we were looking starvation in the face, I think. So I offered the state an opportunity to, you know, to make it up pretty quick, but it wasn't quick enough. I left and went elsewhere.
Nothing in government moves quickly.
But I discovered that.
when people claim that government is inefficient, I say the founding fathers designed it that way. They felt that whatever government did was more likely to be bad than good, so let's make it as difficult as possible for government to do anything.
Now, I've never heard that philosophy before, but I couldn't agree more. Well, that's interesting. All right, the two of you, where did you guys meet?
In a cave.
In a cave. That doesn't surprise me.
No, we didn't actually meet in a cave. We met at a caving grotto meeting.
Yeah. So you guys had very similar interests, just a little different focus. So that was in what year that you met? I know it's been a while ago.
Back in the late 80s.
No, 1986. And the reason I know this is because in high school, I wrote a 50 page term paper on the springs of South Central Missouri, and I was invited to a caving party and told to bring my term paper, and there the hostess of the party gave it to another gentleman who was a mutual friend of ours, and he eventually gave it to Jerry Vineyard, and Jerry was deputy state geologist.
Yes, I knew Jerry.
And it was like, you know, I had done this before Springs of Missouri came out. I was 18. I thought this was my ticket to life.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I got upstaged by the Missouri Geological Survey, but Jerry became a good friend after that. But anyway, because of that, went the lady that had the party had a, she was president of the Merrimack Valley Grotto, and went to meetings and met Eugene there.
There you go. Well, where did work life take you after your all's meeting? What'd you do then?
Well, I was the naturalist at Onondaga Cave State Park, and Joe was in the print shop.
Yeah, I was running the. Basically, I was at an in-house print shop for Sherwood Medical in downtown St. Louis. Uh-huh. And was, you know, became a caver, you know, was doing all the outdoor type stuff. And I had been taking camping as a child. So, I mean, this was not something, you know, this is 9 years of Girl Scouts. That's what happens. But pretty much we were just friends for 6 years. And then all of a sudden one day we said, this is interesting.
Make it a little more interesting.
We tell people we didn't decide to get married. We realized that we were married.
Yeah. Well, that's not a bad deal, you know, and here you are many years later, you're still together and still going strong. But you guys have been involved in so many things across the state of Missouri, and I know you're a caver, Joe, and a geologist, and you've just had some unique opportunities in your lifetime, and you just had one that I'm almost envious of with the National Park Service. Tell us about that.
Well, in 2017, Eugene was in charge of the eclipse outreach for the Missouri State Parks, and I tried to get the city of Pacific to, you know, do a little thing because we were on the center line of the eclipse, and they said no thank you. So I went next door to St. Clair and talked to the city manager, talked to the chamber lady, and on August the 21st in 2017, we had 20,000 people in a town of 4,500 folks.
Wow, and that was where? Where'd you say?
St. Clair.
St. Clair, 20,000 people?
Yes.
She came up with their slogan.
Yes.
Tell them the slogan.
Get your eclipse on Route 66.
The Route 66 people should have loved
yes.
that.
And they showed up.
The center line of the eclipse crossed old Route 66 in St. Clair.
Wow. Yeah, you hit the nail on the head then. Well, where did these people come from, 20,000 people?
In my case, I was actually maintaining an informational website. We had people from 8 foreign countries, every state, 3 of the Canadian provinces. And, you know, they came and they saw the sun go away and then they went away.
How did you handle 20,000 people in that little town?
What we did was we set up 10 viewing stations, and which was about 200 people each. And also, Eugene and I both have done, we did eclipse training for these volunteers. We had 2 volunteers at each station so that they could, you know, they knew what they were talking about. And they could, you know, make certain that people were putting their glasses on and not looking at the sun, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But basically, we went through all this. He was managing the one up on the court, on the state capitol lawn. And so 7 years down the road, it's like we got another eclipse. It's over southern Missouri. We've got people out there who are clueless because it didn't go through over them the last time.
Uh-huh.
And we basically started offering services to, we gave programs for the Army Corps at Wapapello. We pretty much trained a lot of the National Park Service. I mean, they had stuff coming in from their people, too. But
right.
A couple of state parks. And that's how he ended up at Trail of Tears on that day, and I ended up down at Big Spring as the kind of the volunteer coordinator for Park Service. I mean, obviously Park Service had their people there.
Sure.
But I was in charge of all of the eclipse toys for the kids.
What a unique opportunity. I can't imagine you having much competition for those jobs.
Well, you know, it's kind of like, okay, well, when's our next opportunity?
Yeah.
Well, in Missouri,
the big one's 2505.
Yeah. 25. June 2505 is the next time we've got
2505, not 2025.
Not 2025, 2505.
Now, are you going to be around for that one?
Now, there is one coming close on 2024.
Okay. All right. So, man, now you guys sold glasses for the event back at years ago, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I remember ordering those. Yeah. We got glasses from you, and I knew nothing about eclipses and everything, but it's a pretty cool deal to watch. But when you get it come right over your neighborhood, that's not going to happen very, very often, correct?
Yeah. This time, ahead of time, because obviously if you buy these glasses like, you know, a year out.
Yeah.
I think they cost like 30 cents a piece.
Yeah, that was pretty.
But then if you wait till the last minute.
Uh-huh.
In St. Clair, people are offering 10, 20 bucks for a pair.
Wow. Well, I guess that's kind of worth it if you're wanting to watch it, but you don't want to ruin your eyes. So,
well, this last time he bought 3,000.
Yes, that was the minimum order.
Yeah, and basically sold most of them. Some of them we gave away to some schools that needed them and whatever. But we got our money back out of it. We didn't get rich and famous, but.
Provided a good service, though. But what a unique opportunity. And, hey, you guys have some other venues, some other experiences, some other expertise that I want to touch on.
Well, good. Could I do stand corrected. The earthquake is not 2505.
It's Eclipse.
Eclipse. It's 2343. Well, February 25th, 2343. I just looked it up.
Well, that's still a ways out. Well, hey, folks, don't go away. We're going to be right back in a couple of minutes with some very interesting information from Gene and Joe.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Drury Outdoors, and you're listening to Living the Dream Outdoors Podcast with Phil Cooper and Hunter Heineman.
Slow down and enjoy the simple things in life. Welcome to Huzal Valley Resort, providing family fun since 1979. They offer floating, and you can choose from canoes, rafts, kayaks, and inner tubes on the beautiful, crystal-clear Huzal River. Lodging, let us be your home away from home. Choose from a variety of lodging units while still enjoying the great outdoors. With over 2.5 miles of river camping on the crystal-clear Huzal, we're sure you and your family will find the perfect spot to pitch your tent or park your RV. Have fun and let us help you get the most of your stay. Check out our guided trail rides and Karen's Cafe menu. There's something for everyone at Huzal. There's a campground store on site that has everything you need for your trip. Whether you're in need of gear, grub, or something else, chances are they've got it. And their campground has RV sites and primitive sites for all your camping needs. If you like the adventures of camping with a cozy bed at night, we have a variety of different lodging units to choose from. But Huzal Valley, there's always something going on out there. Check them out on Facebook, or if you want to make a reservation, simply call 1-800-367-4516.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Collins with Misty Mountains Guiding Service. I'm here to talk to you a little bit about what we offer. Misty Mountains is a smallmouth and trout-specific guiding service that caters to the northern Ozarks region. My areas include the Upper Merrimack River, the Gasconade, and a few smaller creeks in the Mid-Missouri area. Whether you enjoy casting streamers to bass, drifting a dry fly, or ripping lips with spinning gear, I've got you covered. Fishing is made easy in my state-of-the-art drift boat raft. I control the boat with ease while you or yourself and a buddy do all the work at catching fish. Besides a great day on the water, I provide all needed gear, a delicious shore lunch, and as much fishing knowledge as you can carry with you on the way home. Spots for the 2024 season are going fast. Give me a call or text today to get your trip booked. My number is 573-823-9057. Find me on Facebook and Instagram at Misty Mountains Guiding Service. It's always an adventure with Misty Mountains.
Hi, I'm Steve Stoltz with Woodhaven Custom Calls, Mossy Oak Camouflage, and Drury Outdoors. My turkey tip for the week this week is don't be scared to use a decoy. There's a lot of myths about decoys, but I can tell you this. The Avian X Trophy Tom decoy is one decoy I will not hunt without. Doesn't mean I carry it all the time. There is the time and place for a decoy, but if you need a decoy, use one. For instance, open areas, fields, places that you're set up where you know the turkey is going to see you from a distance, man, those decoys really work. Those Avian X is what my personal favorite decoy is. And I use an Avian X HDR Jake, a lookout hen, and a feeder hen. I like to use three decoys if I can. It just makes it look more natural. Turkeys like to go to the flock. They like They're social birds. So when they see multiple birds rather than just one, they're far more inclined to come to your location. And be smart about how you set your decoys. Don't set your decoys straight out in front of you. And don't set them where the turkeys will see you in between, basically putting you between the decoy's vision and the turkeys. Set them out to one side or the other. So you want to put them, if the turkey's coming from your left, you want to put the decoys a little bit to your right, about 10, 15 yards. And that's the other thing. Don't put the decoys too far from your location. You want the turkeys to come in close for a shot. You hear a lot about reaping with a decoy. Well, let me tell you, it works. And I don't leave home without my Trophy Tom. And I use a real turkey fan that I spread out, salt down, and let it dry out, and I put it in that Trophy Tom. And I can tell you this, every single gobbler that I took last spring was directly a result of using the Trophy Tom and using that visual to bring that gobbler in for the shot. I'm Steve Stoltz, and that's my turkey hunting tip for the week.
Hey, everybody. This is Alex Rutledge with American Roots Outdoors. Check out my buddy's podcast show, Living the Dream Outdoors with Bill Cooper and Hunter Hindman. You're really going to enjoy this week's show.
Welcome back to Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast. I hope you enjoyed that first segment with Gene and Joe. And Gene, we wound up that first segment talking about some of the eclipses coming in the future, but you expressed a concern in the break about the very glasses that were used. There were some fake glasses out there.
This has happened both times. We had this unusual two eclipses 7 years apart, which is not normal. But when you get close, the demand is high. The legitimate manufacturers are swamped.
Yeah.
And the crooks get into the act.
Amazing.
And it's just important to be an informed consumer. Don't wait till the last minute, like the which everyone tends to do, and that's what the crooks count on.
Yeah,
because they started showing up at convenience stores and gas stations, whatever, with little display boxes, and no one had been, you know. These store managers are people too. They wait till the last minute, and exactly. It's like, oh my gosh, we need these, and they can't get them from the legitimate suppliers at that point. And someone comes in and says, "Here, I'll sell you this box of these, and you can sell them." And but they were the labeling was somewhat misleading. But if you knew what you were doing, you could say, "Oh, wait a minute, this." One of the, I'll just say one big red flag. We won't need to list them all, but they said that the seller was not responsible for the glasses.
Sweet.
Well, which I'm sure all those little stores they went to loved. Nowhere did it say on them who made the glasses, who would be the responsible party.
Didn't want to be responsible. So nobody regulating that industry, I guess.
Well, if it comes up twice in two centuries.
Kind of hard to do.
Yeah, do you really want the government spending your money on that? I mean,
you just hope people are going to be smart enough to figure it out for themselves, but we're all not, obviously. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay.
The segue into bats is when the sun goes to totality, when the moon is entirely obscuring the sun, the bats come out.
Absolutely. And Gene is known as Mr. Bat.
Yeah, obviously, we mentioned that I was at got this job with the state parks, having gone, oh, wouldn't this be neat if I could get a job, get paid to do these things I'm doing. And, you know, obviously we were both cavers, but although my master's research was on trees, they don't grow in caves. So I became de facto a bat biologist and did a lot of bat, extremely popular programs on bats. And it's kind of sad that the bats that were so common, no one paid any attention to them, are now in danger of extinction and candidates for federal listing.
And that happened in a relatively short period of time, correct?
Yes. This is all due to a disease called white nose syndrome. Depending on the species, it kills up to 99%.
Wow.
Of the bats.
And that came from where?
Eurasia. You know, you may hear people complaining about multiflora rose and marsh honeysuckle and all these other exotic species. What people may not realize is this is the case you know, go back 400 years. Smallpox and the Indians.
Right.
Smallpox was an exotic species. The Indians had never been exposed to it. Very fatal to them. Dutch elm disease, the chestnut blight, all these things were accidentally, or in some cases intentionally, introduced into this country, and the unintended consequences hit. This was undoubtedly unintentional. We're not sure how it got here. My favorite theory is that an infected bat came across the ocean in a cargo container and infected the bats here.
Wow. Now, what was the response of, you know, controlling agencies, people that had regulatory power over the bats? What did they do in response?
This is basically the winter of 2006-2007. People in upstate New York noticed that bats were dying. They were coming out like in late February and just dying. And that's the reason for a cargo ship coming into New York, one of the big New York Harbor, one of the busiest ports in the world. Mm-hmm. But basically, the first thing that happened was, starting with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, all the federal agencies closed all of the caves on their land, and the states followed. The state closures in Missouri happened in 2009-2010. At that point in time, nobody even knew what the fungus was.
New to science.
Boy, that's tough any way you look at it, isn't it?
And so basically, that pretty much meant the cavers, responsible cavers, weren't going in caves because we had no clue what it was doing to the bats.
Boy, but didn't that shut down a lot of other scientific studies and research? I mean, if you're closing the bat down, you know, the bat caves down, totally, you can't go on them for any reason, correct?
Correct. And this is the reason geologists, hydrologists, historians, paleontologists, people who've been studying things that have been either occur or preserved in caves for, you know, 100 years, pretty much everybody got locked out except bat biologists.
Wow. I bet there was a lot of moaning and groaning going on about that.
It's still going on.
I would imagine so. So this is, you said that they started the closures in 2009, 2010?
Here.
Yeah, that's about 15 years ago. So, boy, that's kind of shutting the shop down. So what's going on in that realm now?
Well, there's been tons and tons of research. They're actually in some vaccine trials, though it's awful hard to vaccinate a wild population.
Yeah.
They're working on some chemical treatments for the bats and the areas they roost to try to kill just this particular fungus and not everything. And one of my favorites is ultraviolet light C, which they also use in hospitals to sterilize things. It's hard to get people to change once they've done something, but I was still with the state, and when we rewrote the state act, parks, not conservation, state parks cave access policy, we made all of the parks caves that had been open restricted, meaning you needed a permit for any one. And this was primarily so we could get to talk to people, because what you want to do is, they love the word decontaminate. We hate it. We prefer to use the word disinfect your gear, which is basically washing it in very, very hot water. Because this is a cold loving fungus, and high temperatures kill it. But anyway, we wanted to talk to people to make sure that they did disinfect their gear. And one of the things I like to stress is you do that before you go into the cave, not after.
Yeah.
If you've been in a cave and you haven't disinfected it, and you go in another one, you might be spreading the spores of this fungus.
The one thing, though, we want to emphasize, and this is what the research has found in the last 15 years, 98 to 99% of this spread has been bat to bat.
Yes.
Because bats, you know, roost in caves in the winter, mm-hmm. and they all cuddle up.
Oh, yeah.
And they actually make little bats during the winter, too. Oh. So, you know, the point is the human transmission of this thing is really not the critical part. The critical part is getting the bats to survive, because they will eventually, you know, they'll get adjusted to it. And we there are some places in the Northeast where the bats were pretty much killed out, and now there are populations which are re-inhabiting these caves, and they're surviving.
Yeah, so, that's cool. The estimates are that it will take best. It will take 200 years for the bat population to recover if nothing else happens in the meantime.
Wow. So has there been any progress made on the killing this fungus at all?
Well, this is what I was talking about right. with the chemical treatments and the vaccines and the thing. But, you know, basically we started at square zero. Nobody knew anything
right.
about this fungus. And unlike the new virus, SARS-CoV-2, which caused COVID, since this does not infect the human population, while it may be a priority, it was not as high a priority.
Gotcha.
But stuff is happening, and, you know, the thing we try to get to with the cavers is, yes, disinfect your gear, and you don't go into the caves when the bats are there.
Gotcha. But if you started disinfecting program for the bats to try to kill the fungus, it's hard for me to wrap that around my head. If you, say, worked on one cave system, are bats going to come out of that cave and go to another cave and vice versa? It just seems like an almost impossible task to accomplish.
It's very difficult in a wild population. And there's all kinds of things. One bat rehabber was treating their bats with vinegar, just spraying them, and reported that they survived, and this was all wonderful. And then so one Colorado official wanted to put vinegar sprays in front of all these cave entrances so the bats would be sprayed when they came in and out. Now, if you walked out of your home and you got sprayed with vinegar, and you went back in and you got sprayed with vinegar, the next time you came out, would you go back again?
Probably not.
But the trick is that did not work.
Oh.
It's the bats were in care. You know, they were in this rehab. They were getting fed. They were all of this kind. It wasn't the vinegar. It was the fact that they were being cared for. Because uh-huh. Joe mentioned this and we touched on it. This cold is a cold loving fungus. This is why people don't have to worry about catching it. Our body temperature is 98.6. The fungus does not like that temperature. The bats, however, when they hibernate, drop their body temperature to pretty much close to what the temperature of the cave is, and the fungus loves that temperature.
Uh-huh.
And so it grows on the bats, and the bats get stressed. They're trying to fight the disease. They're using up their fat reserves because there's no food for them in the winter, and they essentially starve to death.
Wow.
There are more things to that involved, but that's the basic problem. And so, you know, go on, John.
I was going to say the researchers have found that the bats themselves are moving around in the caves, and now some of the species are roosting in different places with different temperatures. And obviously, nobody told the bats to do this. They figured this out.
Figured it out on, kind of survival instinct, I suppose. Well, I overheard a conversation last night, lots of things going on here at the Missouri Outdoor Communicators. And I heard you talking to Shags, I think, and they, Driftwood Outdoors, had just interviewed our new director of the conservation department, and Shags and Brandon took questions, and you had a question, Joe, for the new director about, bat management. What was that question, and what was his answer?
I don't know what his answer was.
You don't know what the answer was.
The question was basically, like Eugene said, the mission statement of state parks involves recreation. Mm-hmm. The mission statement of Missouri Department of Conservation does not. It does involve, however, public access.
Right.
And this was my question for the new director was, if you, pre-WNS, the public was allowed to go in some caves.
Right.
Some caves didn't even have a permit. You just went.
Went. Yeah.
And there were other caves that you had to get a permit, et cetera. And that pretty much all entirely closed down. If you talk to a bat biologist, there are no caves in the world. They're called bat roosts. And I don't know why they're doing that, but they have changed that. I mean, that includes, you know, church towers and people's barns and whatever, wherever bats hang out.
Yeah.
But the question that I had was for Jason Summers was, you know, you're coming into the agency and we, you know, there's 17 years of data now. And no, we are not, people are not asking to go in the winter. We're not asking to disturb the maternity colonies. But is there any movement in the department to going ahead and permitting access to the caves? And this is the reason this came up is because the department themselves they're running school groups for like kids, mm-hmm. you know, K through eight. They're running school groups into some of their caves. But the people who are paying the conservation tax still can't get in.
Uh-huh.
We have the situation with the U.S. Forest Service. They have a contract with the Cave Research Foundation, which is, they are cavers, they are scientists, they are people who do, you know, cave inventory. They think that that encompasses all cavers. It doesn't.
Uh-huh.
And again, the National Park Service at this point has not reopened any of their caves except for Round Spring Cave, which is a tour cave. And that's part of the reason that the Ozark Riverways were made into a national park was because of the springs and the caves and to preserve them for people to enjoy. So, you know, the mix of science and politics is always fun.
Oh, absolutely. And we talked about things taking time earlier and talk about the government. Yeah, when you get into a situation like that, you're looking at a long, long time to get anything resolved.
But, well, and there's an interesting tug of war.
But if you don't squeak, you never get anything.
Exactly.
We talk about the cavers being upset with the blanket closure. They're willing to live with targeted closures that actually protects the bats. It's not the uniform. Everything is closed, object to. But then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is caught between a rock and a hard place, because if you asked most cavers, they would tell you that they are environmentalists. But it's just like the major political parties. You have your moderates and your extremists, mm-hmm. and the Fish and Wildlife Service are being sued. I won't bother to name the organization because I don't want to get in trouble, but to force them to do this,
uh-huh.
And to list additional species, some of which may or may not need it. But so, you know, everybody gets caught in the middle, but this is what Joe said, and this is what we tell the cavers, is there's a lot of we don't want to make waves. We want to cooperate with the federal government. And we tell them, you are not suing the Fish and Wildlife Service, and you want the caves open. These people are suing, and they want the caves closed. Who do you think is going to win?
Yeah. Okay. Kind of wrapping this thing up. You guys have been in this, I don't know what we call it, business, industry, interest, whatever. But you guys have educated yourselves. You've educated a lot of the public. Where do you two want this issue with the bats in a cage, what direction do you guys want it to go, personally? That may be a tough question.
Well, I mean, I said I was in on the writing of the state park one. I think that's the most rational. I'll let Joe answer for what she thinks. But yes, we need to protect the bats. One of the things I've told folks in the Fish and Wildlife Service was up until white nose syndrome, the largest public contingency for bat protection in the country were the cavers. And then overnight, we became the enemy.
And, go figure.
And, you know, and they will tell you that was a serious mistake. But it's, you know, that ship has sailed. But it has created some bad feelings. And
sure.
Bridging the gap now is become difficult. But
basically, prior to this issue with the bats, the cavers in general were very willing volunteers and Sherpas, and not just to do things, you know, very scientifically. I can't tell you the number of cave cleanups that I've been involved with for 10 years. When he was at Onondaga, I had a crew that we were cleaning up Cathedral Cave, and you know, no money involved, just you know,
just hard work.
hard work for the privilege of going into the cave,
right,
and to protect the resources we really care about,
right.
And this is the point, and from the caver point of view, this is 17 years ago.
Wow.
And I'm now 67, so basically, I am at the point. This is not necessarily about me anymore because, you know, body parts. I had a car wreck. I can't crawl, you know, because my knees pinned together. But there's an awful lot of information about caves and caving in the caving world,
right,
that is being lost entirely because it's a mentoring situation. And if you've got a generation who basically has not been permitted to go into the caves, the older people have not really passed that information along.
Boy.
One of the things, it just, critters in general, and I'm not a biologist, but, you know, people are animals too. I mean, we all got to live together, and everybody gets their way sometimes.
Sometimes, exactly. Well, if somebody's interested, or listeners out there are interested in caves or bats, is there an organization that they can join and, you know, help the situation at all?
Well, for information on white nose syndrome, there is a website, whitenosesyndrome.org, and then the National Speleological Society, which is the National Caving Organization. It's just caves.org, correct?
Yes.
Caves.org. Okay, guys, I appreciate having you on the show, but Joe, before we close out here, how can people get a hold of you if they want to take a look at your books? And what's the name of the company again?
Pawpaw Poets Publishing.
And how would they get a hold of you?
Right now, the easiest way to get a hold of me is on Facebook, because one of the things, and this is a volunteer position, I am one of the co-admins for the Current River Jacks Fork and 11 Point Rivers group. We have 180,000 people on there.
Wow.
And we basically, my friend Steve King and I, we do not work for the government. We basically try to steer people between the ditches.
Yeah.
And I would just say, go to Facebook, you know, look up Joe Shaper, and last name, the spelling is S-C-H-A-P-E-R. So that would be the easiest way to get a hold of me.
Okay, very good. Well, you guys have lived quite the interesting life, and folks, I can tell you that Gene and Joe, they're enjoying the outdoors, even though there's some difficult things to deal with out there, and I absolutely love the outdoors, and people, we encourage you to get into the outdoors and enjoy yourself as well. I'm Bill Cooper.
Captain Brian Wilson runs one of the tightest bow fishing operations in the business. Stainwater Bow Fishing operates out of Jerome, Missouri, and the beautiful Missouri Ozarks. They cover most Ozark streams and lakes. You haven't lived until you've searched Ozark waters during the night with Stainwater Bow Fishing while looking for giant gar, carp, and buffalo. Captain Wilson also runs a second boat on Taneycomo Lake. Call today to book a trip with Stainwater Bow Fishing at 573-263-8016. Again, that's 573-263-8016. Be sure and shoot straight.
The Living the Dream Outdoors podcast is brought to you by Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, The Fly Rod Journals, SmokerBuilder.com, Cowtown USA, Westover Farms, Scenic Rivers Taxidermy, Stained Water Bow Fishing, Scenic Rivers Guide Service and Tours, Huzzah Valley Resort, Pico Lures, Devil's Backbone Outfitters, The Fallen Outdoors, Ledco Sinkers and Lure Company, Turnbow Outdoors, J&J Charters, Kaufman Cove, Alaska, Big Ed's Guide Service, Bean Creek Game Calls, Misty Mountain Guide Service, ASO Guides and Outfitters with Ryan Walker, On the Hook TV, Expedition Trailers, The Rambling Angler, Spare Rib Inn in Steelville, Missouri, and Rich's Famous Burgers.
Land ownership is the American dream. Land is the basis of all life. Our wise use of this most precious of resources ensures the survival and growth of free institutions and our American way of life. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we value the traditions and freedoms that land provides us. Every day we seek the solace of a mountain sunrise over traffic jams and smog, the calming silence of a bubbling stream over the sirens of the city, and the quiet of the countryside over the hustle and bustle of the world. We hunt, we fish, we farm. We live off the land. It's our mission to help our clients live out their dreams on the land as we do. At Living the Dream Outdoor Properties, we believe that it's not just land, it's a lifestyle. Join us 5 days a week on Living the Dream Outdoor Podcast as the Living the Dream Outdoor Dream Team explores the most desired outdoor properties in the Midwest and whisks you away to incredible hunting, fishing, and outdoor recreation opportunities. Host Bill Cooper, an inductee of the National Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, will be joined by members of the Living the Dream Outdoors team each week as they tell tall tales, unveil tips and tactics, and rub elbows with some of the biggest names in the outdoor world. You'll also find the Living the Dream Outdoors podcast on your favorite social media platforms, including Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and TikTok.